is Bob Brundage, and the date is still November the 11th, 1997. And I've moved a few miles away into Billerica. The people here in Billerica don't know how to pronounce the name properly. I always pronounce it Billerica. But be that as it may, we're in Massachusetts. And this evening we're talking to Tony Parks, who has been around, involved in the business here north of Boston for so long. So, Tony, tell us a little bit about your family background, where you're born and brought up, and so forth.
Okay, I was born in New York City.
Ah, okay.
In 1949. And you said you were going to ask about my life before square dancing. Well, I can hardly remember my life before square dancing because when I was about 6 years old, we started square dancing in grammar school, and I loved it. And most of the kids could take it or leave it, and I was one of the few that didn't end up hating it by about the time of eighth grade. But
were you still in New York then?
Yeah. I was in New York until 73 when I was 23.
Okay.
Spent my formative years right in the middle of New York City, Greenwich Village. Nice neighborhood, a lot of artsy types around.
You went to a folk dance house?
And I actually did. That was a little bit later. I had a fairly normal upbringing, I guess. I was an only child. I was a bit of a shy kid, and square dancing and folk dancing gave me a place where I could really shine.
Yeah.
You know, gave me something I could do well, gave me a built-in social circle, so I really took to it. We had square dancing in school from about first grade to sixth or seventh grade. And then I went to summer camp in two or three different places, and they always had square dancing there, usually with live music.
Okay.
Starting in 1960, when I was 10, I went to the Farm and Wilderness camps in Plymouth, Vermont. They're a set of Quaker camps. There's about half a dozen of them for different age groups and interest types.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things they emphasize is self-reliance, making your own everything. You know, the kids make their own buildings with help, of course, from the counselors.
Sure.
They make their own, a lot of different things, and they make their own fun. So when they have a square dance, it's a live band, and these days it's kids in the band. When I was there, it was mostly staff, counselors, 18 and up in the band. I think I was the first camper, the first under 18 that they had as a regular musician.
Oh, yeah.
As I said, I started going when I was 10, and I fell in love with the square dancing because at school it had been pretty tame. The music teacher would sit at the piano, and she would give the calls as she played the piano, and it was all kind of genteel. Where at the camps, the caller was one of the counselors, and he would just belt out the calls like Jimmy Durante or somebody, or Eddie Cantor, and there would be a 5 to 10 piece band backing him up. It was wonderful. Some years it would start sounding like Dixieland. We had a head coach who played a mean set of drums on things like Alabama Jubilee, and just because they did a lot of the old standard singing calls from the 40s and early 50s, and some of the patter calls, the Ed Gilmore stuff from the same era. And it wasn't until later, mid-60s, that Dudley Loffman's influence started permeating, and we started doing Contras and some of the older New England stuff. When I first started going there, it was mostly the transitional stuff from the 40s and 50s, you know, when traditional dancing was becoming modern dancing. And I just fell in love with the whole thing. It was so exciting, and I looked at the caller up there on stage, and I saw, you know, he was having a great time, and I saw 100 different people doing the same thing at the same time because he said so.
Yeah.
And I said, I want to be him. And I think right from the start, right from when I was about 10, I knew that I wanted to be a caller. I didn't know if I wanted to do it as a profession, but I knew that, you know, my life was going to involve calling and dance music some way. So the summer I was 12, I tried out for the band, and there was nobody else, I guess, who wanted to play piano full time. So I ended up playing piano in the square dance band that year. And then a year or two later, my voice kind of settled down and decided that
right.
You know, it was pretty much done with cracking.
Right. And not quite as deep as it is today.
Well, it was pretty low.
Yeah.
But I think they had been waiting because they saw I was interested. And I think they'd been just kind of waiting until my voice settled down, because one day they told me I was going to call the next night at my age group's dance. I was about 14, I guess. And I said, Gulp, I am. They said, you are. We've seen you. We know you can do it. So the first dance I ever called was Uptown Downtown to the tune of Golden Slippers. And then the next week, I did my first pattern call, which was Forward, Six, and Back, and the Left Hand Lady Under. And then I did a couple more that summer, I think, and then the following year I did a little bit more. Meanwhile, back in New York City, during the school year, I was looking for whatever square dances I could find in New York, and there weren't many in those days. It was the end of an era, at the end of the big square dance boom, but there were still a couple of places. Dick Krause was calling Teachers College at Columbia University, and he had the only weekly dance that I knew of that had square dancing. He did three squares and three folk dances back and forth all through the evening. And I went there, and I told him I'd done some calling at summer camp, and he said, well, why don't you bring a record next week, and we'll see what you can do. So I did, I brought a record and called. I think it was Just Because. And then he was very kind and very encouraging, and he let me bring a different record every week for several years. And that's where I got most of my early practice. I bought about 10 square dance records, mostly from Michael Herman at Folk Dance House, and from, what was his name, Harry Berliner, whose shop was about two blocks from my house. So I spent a lot of time there listening to records and buying the ones I liked.
I hadn't run across that name in quite a long time.
I also would take the Hudson Tube out to Newark and hang out at the Dance Record Center, Frank Kaufman and the Folk Rap label. And there again, you could listen to the records before you bought them, just like you used to be able to do with popular and classical records.
Right.
And Berliner's was really an old-style music shop. He had records going back 20 or 30 years, and I wish I had been able to get more of them. But I got quite a few. Those were the days. You could get almost anything you wanted at the manufacturer's price. And now, you know, if you find something, it's like $50 for one book or one record. So I was getting plugged into the local scene. I discovered Folk Dance House, and they had a teenage group that met from, I think, 6 to 8 on Saturdays, and I would dance there, and I would dance on Fridays with Dick Krause, and it was, of course, the one called Squares.
Yeah.
And I kept doing it at summer camp, and I guess it was about that time, 64 was the year I started calling, and it was right around that time that I discovered Ralph Page. He was semi-retired from regular calling, but once a year he would come to Folk Dance House, and he would do an afternoon workshop and an evening dance, and that was, I think, when I discovered contras. And of course, they were wonderful, too. I mean, the squares were wonderful. The squares were my first love, and I've never given up on them. Mm-hmm. But the contras were like a revelation, because you could actually hear the music, and the caller wasn't talking all the time. So it was a different kind of fun.
Sure.
And I learned to love them both pretty early.
Right. Did you ever get a chance to dance much?
I've tried to keep my hand in, or should I say my feet, all through the years. Yeah. Boston, we're lucky in that there are several dances a week, and so there's dancing every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and most Fridays, and most Saturdays. Even when I'm not calling, I can get out and dance.
Well, when was it you moved up to the north of Boston?
Okay. I moved out from my parents in 70. And I lived on my own in Queens, New York for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I ran some square dances in New York and got maybe 40 people every couple of weeks and got some more experience that way.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to move to Boston in the early 70s. I ended up actually moving in the fall of 73, just before I turned 24.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I moved was that there were more people involved in playing and calling traditional squares and contras in Boston than in New York. And that's still true, although the New York scene has improved.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more people. I figured there were more people to hang out with. There were more people to learn from, because there wasn't anybody in New York at that point who could show me much. I'd had a lot of nice help you know, the old-time callers, they encouraged me when they saw that I was interested. Mm-hmm. We used to have old-timers nights at Dick Krause's dance. Some of the people who'd been active during the 50s would show up. And then I took, you want names? I'm not sure I can remember them all.
Do you remember Abe Canningson?
I never knew him.
Oh, okay.
He died before I
he did die, right?
Had the chance to meet him.
He was one of those, he was a Mel Tillis stutterer, but he sang beautifully.
Yeah,
I've heard a lot about him. Who were some of the other people?
Let's see, there was a caller named Shorty Williams, there was, it's been years, Cliff Bullard, who was a black guy, one of the few at that time. His specialty was hurry, 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 and
okay.
He did it like nobody else.
Olga Kovitsky.
Olga showed up occasionally.
Yeah.
Let's see. There was a guy named Fred Leifer,
who wrote
the Little Abner Square Dance book.
He's still around.
Is he?
Yeah.
He did a lot with international folk dancing, but
yes.
He was also a caller. He used to go by the name Tex Lightning, but he had given that up by the time I got to know him.
Okay.
And then there was a real tall guy named Tom Stewart, and I got at least one nice call from him. It was to the tune of Last Night on the Back Porch.
Okay.
And so this gang of maybe half a dozen callers, there was another one named Norm Forgash.
I've heard that.
They used to show up every year for this old home night, so I got to know a few of them that way. And then there was a wonderful woman named Betty McDermott, who I met at Marianne Herman's teaching techniques class at Folk Dance House. And Betty was a friend of Don Armstrong, and she also knew people like Ed Gilmore and Manning Smith. She was from Florida, and she went back quite a ways as a dance teacher, although she was retired by the time I got to know her.
Betty McDermott?
Yeah. And she kind of took me under her wing because she thought I had real potential. So she had some of Don Armstrong's concert records, the 45s with the calls on one side and the instrumental on the other, and I would use them like training wheels. I would call along with Don on the one side, and I would flip them over and try to do the same thing on my own. And she would listen, and she would correct me when I got it wrong, and just, you know, give me all kinds of encouragement. She loaned me some of her records. She even loaned me a sound system.
Okay.
And the first contra dance that I wrote, I named Shadrach's Delight, because Shadrach was her teddy bear.
Okay.
Yeah. She had a whole collection of teddy bears. Some of them were you know, regular-sized teddy bears, and some of them were little tiny porcelain ones on a shelf. She just, you know, collected bears.
Right.
And so I was too shy to name the dance for Betty, so I named it for Shadrach. And that's, it was my first contra, and it's probably my best known. It was beginner's luck. You know, I came up with a routine that felt a little bit traditional and a little bit modern. And that was 72 that I wrote that, just before I moved to Boston.
Oh, okay. I'm going to see Don Armstrong another week. Thanksgiving weekend, I go to his contra dance weekend in New York, Pennsylvania. So I'll tell him that I saw you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, speaking of encouragement, I just want to make sure I get in that when I moved to Boston, it was like New York all over again, only more so. The older callers were so overjoyed to find somebody under 50 who was actually interested in calling. Because by then, since about the mid-60s, Dudley Laufman had a big influence on the kids playing the music. There were a lot of young musicians, but there were no young callers yet.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me all the encouragement they could. Ted Sinella, Roger Wynot, Louise Winston. They let me come to their private parties, their one-night stands, to see how they worked with beginners. And again, they did everything they could for me.
Right. How about Mal Hayden?
I never knew him. I've heard he was a good man, but
I
never had a chance. I met Rod Linnell exactly twice. Once when he was just passing through at Maine Folk Dance Camp, just saying hello to his friends. And then once he did a workshop at Folk Dance House when I was still in New York.
Yeah.
I guess it was just before he died.
You were probably there when I was on the staff at Maine Folk Dance Camp.
I must have missed your week, but I might have been there one of the same years that you were there.
Right. Yeah, that was a nice experience. Well, Lawrence Loy had the Recreation Leaders Laboratory up in Maine, too. And Rod and I all came to that one time. I fell in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in one of the recordings that I made, he had given me, but he'd never named it, and I named it Rod's Right and Left.
Oh, that was your name?
That was, yeah.
I have heard your recording of that.
Right.
I also have Rod's own recording of it.
Yeah, right. So I've used that everywhere I went. I used to call it my challenge dance.
Yeah.
Because you get around to these hotshot club dancers, and the higher the level of the club, the worse it looks.
Yep.
The worse it goes.
Yeah, I tell people, in the traditional scene, I call it and I say, there are some kinds of square dancing where people think the more calls you know, the better you are. This dance, aside from the partner change, uses only two calls, ladies chain and right and left through.
Right.
Therefore, it should be an easy dance, no? I love
they
it.
They do basically the same thing, right? But, well, that's fun. Tell us about your keyboard work. You're playing occasionally with other musicians around. You said you're not playing as much as calling, but...
Yeah, since those early days at summer camp, I haven't played too much of the time.
Yeah.
There was a period in the mid-70s when I was playing a little bit more.
Okay.
About a year after I moved to Boston, I met Donna Hines, who is now Donna Hebert. And she is a good contest fiddler and a dance fiddler,
mm-hmm.
and we fell for each other. It was partly that, you know, I'd always had the fantasy of having a fiddler in the family, and she'd always, of course, wanted somebody who played piano or guitar. So we joined forces, we got married a couple of years later, and we founded the band called Yankee Ingenuity. At first, it didn't have a name, it was just the house band at the Country Dance Society's Tuesday Night Dance in the Boston area.
Okay.
And they... this was when the Boston CDS board was trying to put some new life into their weekly bands. They had been using retired callers from the North Boston Callers Association, and attendance was down to about two squares. And they asked Ted Sinella if he would take it over, because he was the most popular caller in the area. On Ted's night, it was five squares,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to the rest of the time.
Yeah.
And Ted said he would be artistic director, and he would call every other week, but he didn't want to commit himself to every week.
Mm-hmm.
And he suggested me as the caller to alternate with him, not necessarily because I was the best in the area, but because my style and my philosophy were the most like his.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be some continuity from week to
right.
week. So in the fall of 75, I think it was, we started this new format, and right away there were complaints that the quality of the calling wasn't consistent from week to week. I never got better so fast as I did that fall. In about 3 months, I think I had gotten good enough so people weren't complaining anymore, and attendance was shooting up through the roof. We had to move to a bigger hall, and for a while we had 250 people every week. And the band, they asked Donna, who had done some substitute work the year before, they asked Donna if she would put together a band. So we found a bass player, and piano was no problem on Ted's night because I would play, and that's when I was doing most of my playing. But we needed somebody for the weeks when I was calling, because you know, I can play when I call, but I don't like to because they both suffer.
Right.
I'd rather concentrate on one or the other. So Donna and I were playing a dance up in New Hampshire, and there was this young fellow named Peter Barnes who was fooling around on the piano during intermission, and Donna said to him, "I didn't know you played piano," and he said something like, "Sure, it was my first instrument," because she knew him as a guitar and banjo player. Now he's mostly a keyboard and flute player, but it was then that we found our piano player, and he's still in Yankee Ingenuity. He's the only original member who's still in it after 20-odd years. But we had a great time for a few years there, and then we had some differences of opinion with the society, and Donna and I started our own dance out at the Concord Scout House near here, and that's been going for about 19, 20 years every week.
Huh. What night?
Monday night.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Well, speaking of Yankee Ingenuity, now let's talk about recording.
Uh-huh.
You've Yankee Ingenuity made some records.
Yeah, the band has made two albums. One is Kitchen Junket, came out in 1977, and that was available on an LP with a double jacket that had the dance instructions on it.
Right.
And that came in two ways, with my calls or without calls. And it's been reissued on a double length cassette with the call version on one side and the instrumental on the other, so the whole thing is on one tape.
Is that right?
And then we did, 12 years later, 1989, we did one called Heating Up the Hall, which is half a dance record and half a listening record. Kitchen Junket is all dance music.
Yeah.
It's all long enough to dance to.
Right.
And the second one, Heating Up the Hall, is more like a concert, although there are some cuts on there that you can dance to. There's a Love Ass Trying, there's a Levi Jackson Rag, there's a real medley and a jig medley. And that came out on all three formats, LP, cassette, and CD. I still have a bunch of LPs if anybody wants one. If not, I'm going to go into the vinyl signing business.
Right.
I bought 30 of them just before people quit buying LPs, so they're still up in the attic. Before Yankee Ingenuity, I helped make a recording called the Fireside String Band. That was in 76.
I've seen that.
And that was to go with Louise Winston's book of Rod Linnell's calls.
Right.
That was music that Rod used.
Yes.
Some of the quadrille music and, mm-hmm. and some of the tunes that had gone out of print on other labels. And I got together an 8-piece band for that, including Donna, who I had just met. And I had already lined up two fiddlers, but I got her in there too, and I think she was the strongest of the three, so I was glad to have her.
Right. I had a thought. I just thought of a question.
It's still going.
Okay, well, I didn't get it.
Pause control is broken.
Right, okay, I had a question that I wanted to ask you now, and I tried to stop the tape temporarily, and I can't remember what the question was now, but, all right, well, moving right along, as they usually say, one of the things I've asked most of the people that I've interviewed so far, what is it that you find appealing about calling the square dance?
Look at anybody's reasons, and for me it's all of the above.
All the above.
Yeah, I love seeing people light up and go, hey, I can do this.
Yeah.
So I love calling one-nighters, or what you might call fun nights, for people who have no idea what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
because I maintain that anybody can dance, and I love proving that to them. I love the chance to use my voice. I've been blessed with a pleasant voice, and I get a lot of pleasure out of the physical act of,
mm-hmm.
of producing the sounds and letting them reverberate. And so there's that. There's I get a bit of an ego boost from it. Who wouldn't?
Oh, sure, right.
And I, in my case, I like the fact that I can make a little bit of money from it. I've been doing it as a substantial part of my living for several years now.
Right. I know the question came back to me. Your Monday night program, what's a typical program, and what's the balance of concerts and
okay.
Quadrilles?
It changed over the years. I'm not calling the Monday dance anymore,
mm-hmm.
as of this year. But over the years, it started with about maybe five contras and three or four sets of squares, two squares to a set. And more recently, it's been about seven contras and two sets of squares, or maybe three. Contras have become more popular, and squares have become less popular among this crowd. And even with two sets of squares, there would be some people who thought that was too many squares in an evening.
Mm-hmm.
And one reason that I got out of there was that I was getting tired of hearing the same thing from the same people all the time, who wanted 12 contras in an evening, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
I have hopes of starting a new series, maybe on a small scale, at least at first, where I can do anything I want. Squares, contras, mixers, couple dances, maybe some folk dances, maybe some singing, play party games,
mm-hmm.
just because I love it all.
Right. Well, that was the next question. That is, in your programs, do you include folk dances and couple dances and all that?
We always have some couple dances, even if it's just a couple of waltzes, a Swedish hambo, a polka, or a shahish. I used to do more international folk dances in an evening than I do now. I'd like to start something like what Tensonella used to do. In almost all of his programs, he would include some folk dances. Mm-hmm. Some of them he would teach, and some of them he would just put on the music for people who knew.
Yeah.
I think that's a great idea.
But no round dances, as we know, as club dancers, no.
Not really.
Yeah.
We'll do something like Salty Dog Rag, which was popular in the 50s, but that's about it.
I've still got that record, but nobody dances it anymore.
Uh-huh.
It's a great dance. Looking back on your career, anything you would have changed? Any regrets?
I might have made more of an effort to get to know some of the people I've worked with a little better.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time, as I said, I was a shy kid. I spent a lot of time getting good at the technical end of calling, the planning and the phrasing and the judgment about when to use certain dances. And I think sometimes I got more caught up in the material and not so aware of the people as people.
Mm-hmm.
But I have very few regrets about my calling and playing. I've loved just about every minute of it.
Right. Tell us about the New England Folk Festival and how you're associated with that.
That's just about my favorite nonprofit group. I've been on the board. I've done various things behind the scenes. Right now I'm on the grants committee that takes the surplus and decides what to do with it. We give scholarships to callers and musicians. We do upfront funding for new dance series and the like. I've been involved in sound. I've been involved in, I can't even remember what all over the years. I've done some writing for the program books. I wrote a souvenir program for the 50th festival. It's amazing. It's been going for more than 50 years now, and it's,
I didn't realize,
you know, it's still going strong. It's one of the oldest big events in the dance world, as far as I know. It started in 1944.
And still on Natick now?
Yeah, it moved around for a while, a different location every year, but it's found a permanent home at Natick High School, which is about 45 minutes southwest of Boston.
Right.
It's a nice central location for New England.
Yes, certainly handy to the New Massachusetts Pike and everything like that. Right.
I think we get about 5,000 people over a three-day weekend.
Yeah.
It's about half contra dancing and half international folk dancing.
Is that much contra dancing now?
Yeah.
I remember, I mean, when I was active in the folk festival, there was not that much contra dancing going on. There was some, but not. And it was usually Ralph Page and company.
Right. Well, if you look at the program books over the years, you can see that the squares kind of diminished and the contras got more popular. And the American dancing, the squares and contras together, has gotten to be a bigger and bigger part of it. So that in addition to being the New England Folk Festival, it functions as sort of the de facto national contra convention.
I see.
Because people come from all over the country, including California now.
Is that right?
Yeah, to come and just be there and take part in the dancing and the calling.
But they still have a major part of the program are the folk dance exhibitions, though.
Yeah, there are four sessions of those that are about 90 minutes each.
Yeah.
And they definitely keep them as a major part of the festival, and of course the folk dancing for everybody.
Yeah. But there wouldn't be contra dances going on while the exhibitions are going on, or would
there? There probably would be. There are two big halls, the main hall and the lower hall, which are like the varsity gym and the downstairs practice gym.
Mm-hmm.
And there are about three or four dance halls and three or four concert halls going all at the same time.
Oh, yes.
When I first started going to the festival in 69, it was just the main hall and the cafeteria where
right.
you got the ethnic food
right.
and the vendors in between in the hallways.
Yes.
And that was it. And
and they added the lower hall, they added a couple other halls, and they keep expanding. They keep getting permission from the school to use more and more rooms.
Right.
So now you can, in the same hour, you can do contras, you can do folk dancing, you can go listen to a concert, you can be in on an instrument workshop or a caller's workshop or a discussion on, you know, where this whole thing is going.
Right.
Or you can feed your face or you can buy things. There's a big crafts hall too.
Right. And a lot of dancing material, caller's material and so forth. What about National Square Dance Conventions?
I've been to roughly half a dozen of those, and I've enjoyed them quite a bit. I gave up going because I just, you know, for budgetary reasons.
Yeah.
But, you know, if money were no object, I'd still be going.
Good.
I would hang out in the Contra Hall, of course, where any traditional squares that happened would be in the Contra Hall as well.
Right.
And there was a whole bunch of people, dancers and callers from all around the country that I started to think of it.
Okay, we just turned the tape over. So you were just saying?
I was remembering the years that I was at the National Square Dance Convention and spent my time in the Contra Hall with a group of people that would come every year from all over the country and converge on the hall. I sort of thought of them as the Contra Mafia. I only saw them that once a year, but they would go back to their communities, as I did, and you know, spread the good word about Contra dancing. Most of them working within the Modern Western Square Dance Network, but you know, one or two mavericks like me.
Uh-huh. Do you remember some of those people?
Let's see, Mona Cannell in Ohio, and Walt Cole from Utah.
Walt Cole passed away.
Right.
Yeah. Let's see, Bob Howell.
Oh, yeah.
Cal Campbell.
Yeah.
Way up in Washington.
Glenn Nickerson.
Glenn Nickerson.
Yeah.
Stu Shacklett.
Yeah, occasionally, I guess.
Kentucky.
I met him somewhere else, but you know, we wouldn't see all these people every year, but you know, some of them would come back.
Yeah, well, many of them were the same as me. When one was fairly handier. Do you remember which cities you did?
Let's see. I started going when it was in Atlantic City in 77. And that was the year that a bunch of us from New England, from the traditional scene, decided to go because we figured it would never come closer than Atlantic City in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to see what it was like and maybe make our presence felt and let people know that there were other ways of doing things just for the fun of it, not to be combative or anything. So Ted Sinella and Roger Wynot and I and probably one or two others that I can't remember offhand went down. That was the 1 year that we had a booth trying to sell our record, but as I said earlier, I think before you turned the tape on, we didn't sell enough of them to make it worth going back as a vendor.
Right.
So after that, we just, you know, we would hand out flyers about our records, but we would just be there to call and to dance.
Did you know Chip Hendrickson?
Yeah, I've been in touch with him off and on over the years.
Yeah. Trying to think of some of the other who might be mutual friends. But, I think we're pretty well, we've been through a half hour and there's certainly been some very interesting facts, unless you think of anything else.
Well, I can tell you asked before who had been the greatest influences on me.
Oh, yes, right.
Well, certainly Ted Sinella, who is just about the greatest traditional caller of our time.
Right.
Dick Ledger, who puts a little bit of modern flair into his calling, but he's giving people good praise, solid material.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot from listening to his recordings, and I also took his caller's course when the New England Folk Festival people sponsored him a number of years ago.
Okay.
I would say that my biggest influences in terms of calling style in the traditional scene would be Ralph Page, Ted Sinella, and Dick Krause. And you know, in the modern Western movement, probably Dick Ledger and Ed Gilmore. I never met Ed, but I have a lot of his recordings, and I have a lot of respect for what he did for the activity.
Well, you missed a great one. I mean, not having met him, but so. Well, I think you've pretty well covered most everything that I wanted to find out about you. Do you have any other hobbies?
Let's see. I've been into model railroading off and on over the years. Got rid of most of my trains when I decided that they were owning me. You know, that I just didn't have the space or the money to keep up with the hobby. I've stayed in it in a small way. I have my father's old trains. Somewhere in the last few years, I started collecting roller coaster rides because nobody can, you know, they don't take up space in the attic, and nobody can ever take them away from me. My parents say that as they get older, they're spending their money more and more on experiences rather than things, and I think that's a good plan. I've enjoyed traveling. One of the things I've loved most about calling is that it's given me the chance to travel and see different parts of the world and to meet new people, and I'm hoping to continue that. I've been to Denmark 3 times now.
Great.
Been to England once, up to Alaska, Belgium, all over the lower 48.
Right. Did you call and do some calling while there?
The Danish tours were all as a caller.
They were.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a woman named Margot Gunzenhauser who was born in New York and went over to Denmark for a year of college and liked it so much that she decided to stay. And she has taught about 200 people in Denmark to call traditional squares and contras.
Ah.
And now she's hoping to teach some of them how to give caller schools themselves to spread it that much faster.
That's interesting.
And so she's had me over there twice as a caller to do dancer workshops and parties, and most recently as a caller coach to try to teach other callers how to be caller coaches themselves. And that was a new experience for me.
I'm sure. Oh, that's really interesting. So. Well, it's getting kind of late at night, and it's Labor Day tomorrow for you, and I'm on my way to Connecticut. So I think maybe we can just wrap this up, Tony. And I want to thank you very much for taking the time to sit down and put these thoughts down on tape.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'll put them in the Lloyd Shaw Dance Archives out in Albuquerque. And incidentally, we're going to try to arranged to send copies to the Square Dance Foundation of New England, too. You've been affiliated with many of those people, I'm sure. The Square Dance Foundation of New England, like the Dixons that I just talked with, and people like that, Dick Severance.
I've met Dick and Judy.
So, once again, thank you very much, Tony. And I think we'll call this a conclusion of our interview with Tony Parks in Billerica, Massachusetts. And thank you very much.